This is Mame Warren. Today is December 31st, 1996, and I'm celebrating New Year's Eve with Nick Leach in Roanoke, Virginia. So you were just telling me you arrived in Lexington from Covington?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Covington, Virginia, about a 45-minute drive west of Lexington on 64.
So did you know Lexington before you came
to
school?
Yeah, my mother loved the town. My father's uncle, Tommy King Loving, was an alumnus. He graduated from WNL in the late 50s, I think, and taught school for a while in Vesuvius, and then was diagnosed with tuberculosis, and he relocated to Arizona, but died fairly young. But anyway, there was a family connection to the school. I liked it. I had been an admirer of Robert E. Lee ever since I was a kid. I was a member of the Children of the Confederacy, which was a historical group that struggled to teach the truths of history, as they say in the Children's Creed. Let's see, one of which was that the war between the states was not a rebellion, nor was its underlying cause to sustain slavery. That was in the creed that you had to read before every meeting. I sort of quibble with some of the definitions now, but one of the state conventions for the Children of the Confederacy, when I was the state chaplain, took place on the campus at Washington and Lee, and that was my first experience on the campus. That probably happened in 1976 or 7, something like that, and we got a tour of the colonnade and the chapel, which I thought was fabulous. The recumbent, Valentine's recumbent statue was there, but more importantly, Miss Emily Pierce was there, and she was phenomenal. She sat down, she talked about the Lee family, and she knew a lot of sort of interesting anecdotal history. In fact, she used to joke, and she said one time she was doing her spiel, and a kid asked her if she knew General Lee, and she certainly talked the talk, but she played the piano, too. It was incredible. She sat down at the piano after she finished her talk and played the swing, and it sounded like she had sprouted two additional hands. It was just, it was one of the most amazing things I'd heard. So that really started my serious interest, I guess, in
Did you know it was the swing?
She said that. She said what it was. It was the school's fight song, and she said it had been copied a lot of times, and a lot of people used it. But she talked about when it was originally composed, and you know, I'd heard it before, but I'd never really known that it was the swing.
Same here. When I started this job, and Frank Parsons started talking about the swing, and I said, "What is this? What are you talking about, the swing?" And he said, "When you hear it, you'll know." And I said, "Look, I never heard this thing. I don't know what you're talking about." And when I heard it, I went, "That's the WNL swing."
Yeah, you kind of know. Yeah. So.
And now I hear it everywhere, all the time.
Yeah, it's pervasive. Well, so WNL was the only school, I applied early decision and was accepted. So I can say that I never applied to any university other than Washington and Lee University. Same thing for law school, too.
Can you remember your first impressions? When you first saw the campus?
As a kid? Or as a...
Whenever.
Well, the first time I saw it, I guess I was a sophomore. Well, no, that's not true. I had seen the campus from, you know, just driving by and just thought it looked kind of like this magical place. I know it sounds hokey, but it really looked... I don't know, just it looked otherworldly. Once you've seen Covington, perhaps everything looks palatial and otherworldly, but this place really did. And the first time I was on the campus was, I guess, a sophomore in high school. I remember the bricks. I remember the bricks that have the impressed patterns in them. That stood out. I don't know why, because I was sure no aficionado of architectural style or anything like that, but I remember thinking the structure looked so old. That's probably what it was. And all these guys walking around learning stuff. That's how it hit me, really. It just seemed, I don't know, I guess it really had an effect. And the colonnade, you know, the group of us, you know, we were sort of ushered up and down the colonnade a couple times and then down the long walkway to the chapel. Yeah, just the age of it, I guess, was one of the things that really struck me.
You're the first person to mention the bricks, and I love those bricks.
Oh, really? They're just, and you know, they're so irregular, and they're so... Professor Stevenson, he was in the German department, used to live in the barn behind Call Alto. You know where Call Alto, the big residence on Nelson Street that the university had but couldn't use, so let go. He used to live in the barn for years and years, and he had gotten his hands on a whole stockpile of bricks and had buried them out at the barn, and he dug them up when he had to move. He dug them up and gave them away. And I sort of kick myself now that I didn't just, you know, grab a couple of them, but I didn't. The bricks were one of the first things I noticed, though. They really were. Shouldn't affect us, though.
So you arrived as a student. What was your experience then?
I was pretty, daunted, I guess is the right word.
This is 1980?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A part of it, I guess, was just the natural being away from home, that kind of junk. But our dad and I unloaded my stuff. I lived in Davis dorm up on the third floor. I remember when we were loading stuff, there was this other tall guy who walked by me and said, "Hi, Nick." And I said, "Hey," and kept on walking. And I couldn't, you know, I saw him a couple more times and thought he sort of looked familiar, but I couldn't think of, you know, I had no idea who he was. And Dad had heard him say, "Hey, Nick, too." And Dad said, "Well, maybe there's a Facebook or something like that. And, you know, he knows your face from the Facebook." And I'm like, gee, I don't know. It turned out, when I started talking to the guy, his name is David Miller. He's from Selma, Virginia, which is 10 miles away from Covington. And he dated a girl that I knew from back home, and I just didn't recognize him. I'd met him maybe once before and didn't recognize him. He's turned out to become one of my best friends. It was really kind of weird. Sort of paranoid, you know, thinking, oh gosh, there's a Facebook and people already know who I am. And I had a friend, Jeff Wells, during orientation. He was going for a walk down by the Doremus gym, and there was a dollar bill just lying on the path that he was walking on, and he saw it and he stopped and he thought about picking it up, and then he thought, well, no, maybe this is an honor code test or something, and I'm being watched. So he left it on the ground and went on walking. But you did feel like, I guess, during orientation in the first few weeks of class, I did kind of feel like sort of a fish out of water, you know, trying to fit in to the new environment, but not really sure, you know, of the right thing or, you know, right things or wrong things to do. It was kind of weird. Which is why it was a stupid time to have fraternity rush, I think. It was really, because you got rushed like crazy during orientation and during the first few months of school. I think they put that off now. They don't do it until the winter term.
This is the first year.
That makes a lot of sense to me, frankly. I don't know if it'll make the fraternity census go down. That's probably what the houses were afraid of. But, I mean, it's such an adjustment, I think, to begin with, to be on your own. You know, nobody's going to wake you up and get you to class. Nobody's going to make you, you know, prepare your assignments. It's Not that my parents made me do everything, you know, far from it, but it was a real, such an environmental change that I think it makes sense to put things off a little bit as far as the frats were concerned.
You've talked about four things I want to pursue here.
Sorry, okay.
That's okay. All right, first let's talk about, was there still freshman camp when you arrived? You're mentioning orientation.
Yeah, there was a week. I don't recall the phrase freshman camp being used, but I remember getting there like on a Sunday. And then Monday, I think you had dinner in the dining hall Sunday night, and then there was a, I remember meetings, you know, in the chapel, class-wide. There were various tests you had to take, placement tests. I had taken 3 years of French in high school, was not interested. I wanted to take a language, but I was not interested in taking French. I just had sort of felt, you know, been there, done that. But they went ahead and made me take the French placement test, which I thought was kind of dumb, but I did it, and I placed out of, you know, placed into intermediate French, which was nice, I guess, but it was kind of like, well, thank you very much, but I want to take Russian, and so I signed up for Russian instead. But there was a whole week of tests, and you met with your advisor, and each student was assigned a faculty advisor to kind of help shepherd him, so to speak, through the, you know, the initial phases of signing up for classes, you know, thinking about the various distribution requirements that applied. You had to have X numbers of credits from different groups like math and science, which was the bane of my existence, and then language, which was the joy, that kind of stuff. But there was a whole week where you had all of that stuff, and fraternity, you know, representatives from the Interfraternity Council spoke to the class, and, you know, you met with brothers from various houses, and that all happened during that first week, as I recall. I don't know if that's camp or not.
No, there was something in earlier years, and I'm not sure when it stopped, but they used to literally take them off to Natural Bridge, and before that it was somewhere else. And they truly were in camp, like a summer camp for a week.
Before
all
my
that
time.
Happened, yeah, all that happened somewhere else. But I think that ended some years before you got there. Yeah,
they took us out to Liberty Hall, you know, to look at the ruins as part of the early sort of historical, you know, 1749, that was the year that was, and sort of talked you through it from there. But no, we didn't have a camp experience.
So obviously one of the things that was brought up very early on was the honor system. If this guy saw the dollar bill and thought he was being tested.
Day one.
Tell me about how you learned about that and what it meant to you.
Well, to be real honest, you knew about it when you applied. I mean, the honor code was one of the things, and I hope still is, one of the things that the university pushed, you know, in terms of letting you know about Washington and Lee. I mean, that always came up. That came up during interviews. When I had just applied and went to school, went to campus for interviews, and I remember talking with Dean Hartog, and I got to sit in on some classes, sat in on an English class, a philosophy class. But the honor code came up even, you know, that early as being an integral part of the university and of life on the university. And if memory serves, we got, you know, a packet or packets of materials when we arrived, and one of the things, you know, was the white book. And it was treated as a big deal, but in a very appropriate way, I thought. You know, I never locked my dorm door. I had a carrel, you know, stacked full of stuff that was important to me, and I never gave it a second thought the whole time I was there, because it was just not something you had to worry about. And that's why when there were honor violations or public trials, it was just such a huge deal because that kind of thing just never happened. But that was a real important part of orientation, especially you talked about that. If memory serves, the first time we all got together as a class, that was what we got together to talk about. So it was important. I hope that hasn't changed.
No. In fact, I went to the session this year with the freshmen. I pretended I was a freshman this year.
Oh, good.
And it was impressive.
Yeah. You know,
if they didn't, by the end of that evening, if they didn't understand how serious it was, they didn't belong there.
Right.
But they did seem to take it pretty seriously. So the other thing that you mentioned was Rush.
Yeah.
Tell me about Rush.
You'll probably need to talk to somebody else to get an accurate picture of that. It was not my thing.
That's why I'm asking you.
I'm
interested in the fact that it wasn't your
thing. Yeah, but just the whole fraternity scene just really was not my thing. Which is not to say that I didn't like to, you know, have a good time and party and drink beer, etc., or other things. Or the first party I remember going to, was it SPE? Well, SIGEP, they call it, Sigma Phi Epsilon House. And I remember walking in the door, and there's this bathtub sitting in the front hall with fruit floating in it. And it was my first experience with grain punch. Just fruit floating in it, and, you know, plastic cups stacked up beside you. You just kind of walked in, knocked yourself out, literally. I don't know how to... I'm not knocking the system at all. I don't think that was a particularly good time for the fraternities at WNL.
Talk to me about that.
Just a whole lot of massive consumption of alcohol. Just behavior. I don't know what you call it, vandalism, you know, breaking things just merely for the sake of breaking them. Loud, aggressive, just sort of the epitome of all the things that you really don't like to see in people is what I saw when I went from house to house, you know, with all the other little doe-eyed freshmen, I guess. Just really wasn't my thing. You had the mandatory attendance at parties. You know, if you were a brother, you had to show up at parties, and if you didn't show, you were fined. I just didn't need that. I wasn't really interested in that.
How did it break down in your class? How many people did sign on, and how many people stayed independent?
I mean,
I'm not looking for exact numbers. I'm talking about for feeling.
My recollection is that it was about 60-40. As I say, I'm not sure that was the heyday, really, of the fraternity system. Maybe the proportion is higher now. I don't know. That was the one thing about WNL that I thought was... And it was perhaps symptomatic of the all-male nature of the institution, but, I mean, when you've got guys, you know, walking around dirty, carrying spit cups and dipping skull, using poor language, and I think there's a place for those Saxon words, and frankly, I use them myself with frightening regularity, but, I mean, just... that was all there was. Some days it seemed like you were just, you were kind of, I sound like such an effete snob by saying all this stuff, but the behavior was really coarse and pretty rough. And I like to think coeducation has changed that, at least to some degree. I think when you're surrounded by potential love objects, you're not going to behave quite like that. That's phrasing it badly, but I think the behavior, or my thinking was that the behavior would change some if there were women present. I was part of the vocal minority that was kind of pro co-education during those years. I was real happy when that decision was made.
Well, let's not quite skip to that yet, but I do certainly want to talk about that. Were you attracted initially to the fact that the school was all male?
No, it wasn't. That was one of the concerns my mother had about me going to WNL, was that there weren't women there. And I had, growing up, I had several close friends I had were female. And I guess Dad, to some extent, said, you know, well, gee, you're going to have to travel. You're going to have to drive to Holland to find a girlfriend. And I was like, well, you know, that's okay. That's not, I didn't really see it as being a... It was neither a plus nor a minus. It just was sort of the way things were at WNL, and you kind of accepted that. Once there, though, and I said this to Kathy before, too, that if WNL had remained single sex, and we had a son, I wouldn't have discouraged him from going, but I'm not sure I would have actively encouraged my son to go to WNL, just because I'm not sure. I mean, I feel like the education I got was excellent, and I think my worldview was sufficiently set by the time that I arrived there that the single-sex environment wasn't going to alter it or skew it that much, but I'm not sure, at least during the time that I was there, that it was a really healthy... I'm not sure it was a... Some of the people who had some of their attitudes formed at WNL, I'm not sure during that time that it was a great place for those attitudes to be formed. And basically just in dealing with women, I used to wonder, you know, gosh, what's going to happen when some of these guys... leave college and they have careers somewhere and they've got to report, you know, to a woman, or what are they going to do? How are they going to deal with women in authority? I would not have encouraged my son to go, but if we have children, I think I'll definitely probably, well, not definitely, probably, I will definitely push WNL as a co-ed institution.
Do you think other people who went there were attracted because it was single sex? And at that point, it was sort of a bastion. It was one of the last places. Was that talked about? Was that there an awareness that you were among the last? And was co-education an undercurrent while you were there?
It was talked about that WNL was one of the last remaining male single-sex institutions in the country. Talked about fairly proudly. I really don't recall much talk during my early years there. I would imagine it was going on. I just was oblivious. But I don't remember much talk. I remember when President Wilson came, I guess in the fall of 83, I guess, is when he arrived. It started being talked about more, and I think that probably was one of his campaign planks, I guess, when he was being considered for the position. I think was he at least was mentioning the notion that they needed to consider SAT scores and all that stuff, I guess. I don't know. I don't remember hearing much about it in the earlier years.
So once he arrived, what was the reaction as it started being talked about?
For the most part, negative. among the student body, you know, it was change. You were gonna, I don't know, mess up the boys' club. The frats were really against it. You know, that was one of the big selling points, I think, of the fraternity system was, you know, we're an all-male school. The social focal point, or focal points that would attract women, are the fraternity houses and the parties that get thrown there. So if you want to meet women, if you want to be social, you really need to belong to a fraternity. And coeducation, I think, really jeopardized that whole system. I don't think it was represented the death knell, but I think it really changed the way the fraternity system worked at Washington and Lee. And so the frats were obviously all against it. I don't know. A lot of my friends, well, a few of my friends, I guess, were pro, like I was, but you didn't talk about it too much because you just, you know, would cause an argument. I know the identity of the guy who, one of the guys who climbed to the top of Washington Hall and put a dress on the statue of George Washington on top, and there was a banner, "No Marthas." I know one of the guys who did that, and that was, you know, that sort of represented the majority view, I think. Don't change it, it'll irrevocably damage what Washington and Lee is. I think that was the notion. I disagreed pretty violently with that notion, but that's what most people thought.
Did the t-shirt start up while you were there?
Yeah, I believe so. I don't know, don't recall if they sold them in the co-op or not. I really don't remember. I'm sorry, I think we have plumbers.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. There we go.
Lots of plumbers.
Well, if there's a water line problem that they're gonna have to deal with. I can't remember if they sold them on campus, you know, if it was sanctioned by the back then the bookstore and the co-op were two distinct entities. I worked in the bookstore all 4 years, work study. Sold Frances Lewis some bargain books too. That was my crowning achievement. She had these books that she wanted to buy, and I didn't know who she was. And I said, "Oh, you know, the last edition of this, it was an art book or something like that." I said, "You know, the last edition of this is not real different, and it's over in the remainder section. You can get it for about 25%. And so she said, "Oh, great." So she put it back, went over to the remainder section and got that. And then wrote me a check, and, you know, "Thank you very much." And as I'm ringing it up and putting the check in, I saw, you know, Sidney Lewis, Frances Lewis, and I went, "Oh, Jesus Christ." I just sold the Lewis's bargain books. And I told the bookstore manager, Betty Munger, that, and she just died laughing. It was funny. I can't remember if they sold the No Marthas and the anti-co-ed t-shirts on campus or not, but yeah, they started making the rounds.
Betty wouldn't have let that happen if she had anything to do with it. Of course, she was only in the book section, wasn't she?
Right. But she was pro coeducation, big time, so you're right.
She was pro coeducation back in the 40s.
Well, you're kidding. She told me the greatest story. She went to Bennington. She told me the story of one, this has nothing to do with WNL except Betty Munger was there. One summer, she and another girl from Bennington worked for this family out on Long Island. Long Island? No, that's not right. Well, the geography doesn't make much difference, but in New England, worked for this fairly wealthy New England family as sort of governesses, and there were a number of children, and she remembers, you know, one son being really attractive, and she kind of had a crush on and blah, 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 and playing tennis with him, and one of her jobs was to wake up every night at 2 and wake up little Teddy and take him to bed, or take him to the bathroom so he wouldn't wet the bed. And it's the Kennedy family. She took a little little Teddy to the potty in the wee hours. She had a bunch of neat stories.
I've never heard that, and I know Betty very well.
Yeah, I remember that story. Yeah, I kind of doubt you could have bought those T-shirts in the bookstore, but they were there. They were there during probably my last year on the undergrad side, 83, 84.
So did you have any T-shirts to the contrary, or did you try to stay pretty undercover with your opinion?
I didn't try to stay undercover. I mean, I was happy to talk about what I thought, but I didn't have any T-shirts to the contrary. I guess I wasn't a T-shirt guy.
Was there an open discussion going on about coeducation? Was it an ongoing thing? Was it in the dining hall? Where did the subject come up, and how did it get talked about?
As I recall, there were debates periodically on campus, you know, pros and cons.
Real debates?
I seem to remember. I never went to any. Mm-hmm. I seem to remember sort of a couple formalized discussions, but I don't remember anything else about them other than that they occurred. I didn't participate or attend. I don't think anybody seriously thought it was going to happen. I mean, it was talked about, and you know, privately, little conversations occasionally might turn to the subject, but I don't think anybody really seriously thought, at least nobody I knew really seriously thought, that things were going to change. So it really was not, you know, it was an issue, and you'd talk about it, and it'd be like a hot point for a second or two, and then, you know, the other 23 hours and 59 minutes out of the day, it was not really an issue. It wasn't, you know, it might have been in the background, but it wasn't a big thing. You know, from my perspective, the upcoming Glee Club concert or the English paper I was writing for Dr. Cowling was a lot more important, to be honest, than, you know, the future direction of the universe. I don't think anybody really saw it as being something that was going to happen, certainly not as quickly as it did.
Was there any sense when John Wilson arrived that a real sea change was happening?
Dacron John, yeah.
Tell me what you mean by that.
People made fun of his clothes, hence the Dacron reference. You know, the guy from Virginia Tech, you know, the farm school down the road, who's coming to take the reins at Washington and Lee, and oh my God, what happened here? You know, that I think the view was that he was no real replacement for Bob Huntley, at least among the student body. I don't know what the faculty thought. I really don't. I mean, the faculty members that I was close to on a personal basis were Dr. Spice and Professor Stevenson. Those were the two faculty members that I felt like I knew well. I think Spice was pretty happy, and Stevenson was not. He was not in favor of coeducation, so he and I didn't talk about that all that much. But, there was a feeling that big change was coming. I don't think anybody thought big change would have been something as fundamental as the chromosomal makeup of the student body, but it was. And quickly, too. I mean, the announcement was made in the summer of 1985, I believe, at the C school. I came over, I was working that summer at the law school, and there was going to be, you know, the big announcement, and so I came over for the news conference and was there when...
You were there? You were the first person I've talked to who was there, who wasn't a participant.
You guys are way too much.
Yeah, I was there.
Tell me that scene. Take me to that scene.
Oh, it was in one of the big conference rooms, you know, the big classrooms there in the C school. You know, there's circular, semicircular shape kind of classrooms, media, you know, TV cameras. I remember WDBJ Channel 7, your hometown station, it was there. Reporters, and I don't remember the substance at all, but I just remember, you know, wow, it's really, you know, it's really going to happen. I remember being, I think the buzz was that that's what, you know, the decision was going to be. I don't think it was much of a surprise, but just being there to hear the proclamation read, so to speak, was kind of
What was the feeling in the room?
Well, there was more than one. A lot of people were happy. A lot of people were really profoundly unhappy. Professor Stevenson was despondent for weeks. Futch was furious. There was just confidence that giving from alums was just going to, you know, drop off to nothing because we were changing, I guess in all caps, we were changing Washington and Lee. And out there, maybe they did, they probably did have a dip, I think, in giving. I think some people really, it was funny, my mom was not in favor of coeducation. She, which I always thought was kind of interesting, but she, you know, said there's so few single-sex schools, you know, left for men, and we ought to hang on to a few of them. And I was always like, you know, well, if all an institution has, you know, to distinguish itself from other institutions of higher learning is its, you know, single-sex student body, it's not much good. I mean, if that's the big thing that recommends that college, you probably would be better served going somewhere else. So anyway, there were lots of moods in the room. You really did. It feels so cheesy and so corny to say, you know, you were there when, like Walter Cronkite, you were there. You know, when history was being made, but you really did kind of feel like you were, you know, the big decision had already been made, but you were there for the formal announcement, as it were, of what that decision was, and it felt kind of weird. I was happy. I was already over in the other environment at that point, and it was pretty big news over there too. There was some hope that the underweenies might become a little more civilized when there were women there. It's so weird how distinct the two, you know, you really cross more than a ravine when you go over from the undergrad side to the law side. There really are two completely distinct worlds.
Well, I certainly understand your desire to be there when it happened, because when the Supreme Court decision came down a few months ago, I was over at VMI in 5 minutes.
Were you?
I ran. I said, I want to be there. I want to feel it.
Again, not much surprise there for that proclamation.
No, but, boy.
Same thing.
There was a lot of dread. Just dread.
Oh, yeah.
In that room. There were no smiles except mine. But I tried to be gracious. I tried to be good. I tried to be a good neighbor.
Well, the logistics for them were just going to be so much tougher, I think, than they were for WNL. I mean, it was fairly easy to convert floors of dorms or even whole dorms into women's dorms at VMI. It's so much, I mean, you really do have to change everything over there.
So, just to sort of try to continue the co-education thing, You did graduate from the undergraduate level, but you stayed in the vicinity because you were at the law school.
Yeah.
So you saw those physical changes start happening to the campus.
Mm-hmm.
What did you see? What did they have to do?
I'm trying to remember. Because truly, I was over for the odd concert or two on the undergrad side, and occasionally I'd come over to the co-op and grab lunch. But I really wasn't on the undergrad campus. that much. I know there was construction. I know there was work on dorms.
So you weren't reading the FI or anything?
You know, I really didn't. And I've often wondered if there was something fundamentally wrong with me that I sort of made, I won't call it a break, but my relationship with Stevenson suffered. I haven't really piled up that many regrets in my life, but that was one of them that I kind of cut, well, if not cut, really frayed some ties to the undergrad side. And I'm not sure why I did it, other than you were focusing so much on law.
Well, that's a consistent thing. You're not the only person who did that.
It's really well, my new girlfriend too, Kathy. She required some attention too. That was pretty much all I had time for. So I really don't really remember that many structural or fundamental changes going on. I just know that it was in the works. And you would see, I mean, even before the co-education decision had been made, there were Hollins girls and girls from other girls, and I don't mean that disparagingly at all, but they can call us boys, it's fine, I don't mind. But there were women from like Hollins or Sweetbriar or Randy Mack who would be exchange students, who'd be taking classes with us periodically. So it wasn't unheard of to see women in class. But the notion that there were going to be a lot more of them was really different. I don't really remember any structural changes, other than I just have this vague impression of construction going on somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's get back to the fact that you didn't join a fraternity. What is one's social life if one does not belong to a fraternity?
Pretty good, really. There are times when I felt like I was cheating because, although I didn't belong to a house, a lot of my friends, you know, sort of scattered to the four winds as far as houses were concerned. So I'd be over at Spee one weekend and at, you know, Phi Psi another, hanging out with the Kappa Sigs. My fraternity was the Glee Club. I mean, that was the fraternal organization that I belonged to. You know, music had always been such an important part of my life. And that was just amplified exponentially when I got to WNL, and the Glee Club was really the group that I socialized with.
Talk to me about that.
What do you want to know?
I want to know all about being in the Glee Club.
It was great. I had never, you know, I'd sung all my life, and then sung in choirs before, but I'd never really sung. You know, four-part male voices, and it's such a great sound. I mean, it's just such a neat sound, and that whole area of music was just terra nova for me, and I loved it. I just thought it was so great. So many different things were opened up to me, you know, as a result of being in the Glee Club. Composers, styles, and it was fun. I mean, we had a great time. Dr. Spice was just a terrific, terrific conductor. Concerts were a lot of fun. The parties after concerts were always fun. We'd work up things in conjunction with the Hollins women or the Sweetbriar women or the Randolph-Macon women and perform, you know, mixed chorus stuff with them, either at WNL or at their school, and then have great parties afterwards. Glee Club tours were always fun, were always different. And the friendships that I made, all the friends that I keep track of from college, with very few exceptions, are Glee Club friendships. Todd Jones just died, and we just had a memorial service for him December 7th, I guess it was, and we had people come in from California, from Alabama, from North Carolina, from Indiana. I mean, there were people from everywhere who came back to WNL for that service, and that's, I think, not only a testament to Todd, but I think it is indicative of the kind of friendships that were formed in the Glee Club. You got to know everybody really well, and we're a real cohesive unit. And not all of them were limp-wristed, effete, you know, singers. I mean, most of them were just like normal guys who liked to sing, and it was fun. The first year we went on tour, we went up the East Coast, we went up Baltimore, Manhattan, Long Island, and just sang for various alumni chapters, and we sang in the National Cathedral with Goucher College. I got to play the organ at the National Cathedral. We were doing Benjamin Britten's Rejoice in the Lamb, and I was the organist, and that was something. They have a 128-foot pedal.
Wow.
At the National Cathedral. You don't really hear it, you just kind of feel it. There's kind of this odd rumbling, shaking when you use that stop. And I got to play at St. Patrick's, too, in New York, which was fun. But that stuff was always... Glee Club, performing for alumni was great because, well, the bars were always well-stocked, and it was kind of fun to chat up, you know, somebody from the class of 55 or 60 and talk about, you know, WNL and the WNL experience. And we used to do stuff for Mr. Whitehead, too. Have you met Jim Whitehead?
Mm-hmm.
Great guy. Gosh. He was... The Reeve Center was his big project then. And I remember, I guess it was my freshman year, there was a group of wealthy Texans from the Texas alumni group that were up in Lexington for a weekend or something like that. And Whitehead wanted to schmooze him and was trying to get